Hello and welcome to the Awaken to Wholeness Summit. I'm Val Salidkar. Today we are blessed to have with us an incredible visionary for our world, a man the Leadership Project in 1998 called one of the 30 most influential senior leaders in higher education and one of the 10 key agenda setters of the past decade. In 2011, the Utne Reader named him one of the 25 visionaries on its annual list of people who are changing the world. Dr. Parker J. Palmer. Parker is a writer, speaker, and activist who focuses on issues in education, community, leadership, spirituality, and social change. He is the founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal. Parker holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California at Berkeley, as well as 13 honorary doctorates. He is the author of 9 books, including several award-winning titles that have sold over 1.4 million copies and been translated into 10 languages, including The Courage to Teach, A Hidden Wholeness, and Let Your Life Speak. His latest book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit, has been called one of the most important books of the early 21st century by the Journal of Democracy and Education, and was chosen by Spirituality and Practice as one of the best books of 2011 on contemplation and social activism. Parker.
Hi, Will.
Hi, it's wonderful to have you with us. You have really given so much to our world. Really.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a joy to be in this world, right? It's a gift.
It is a gift. And it's a gift to recognize that gift. Because a lot of us, I think we move so fast, we stop remembering to take those moments to be grateful and recognize how we can really show up in the world with all that we have inside of us.
Well, it's good to be with you, and I'm glad you're in the world too.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'd love to just begin with a little bit about your journey and kind of what led you into the human spirit in such a profound way.
Well, at age 77, that could be a very long answer, you know, so you probably don't want me to go back to the covered wagons and all that, but I'll just say very briefly that I grew up in an affluent suburb of Chicago, Illinois. And went to Carleton College up in Minnesota, felt very blessed to be at such a fine institution as that. Thought I might want to go into the ministry, so I went to Union Theological Seminary in New York City for just a year when God told me that she didn't want me to have anything to do with her church and sent me out to Berkeley in the 60s, which I think is proof that there is a God. It was an amazing experience, a real wake-up call for me. Being in New York City for that year was a wake-up call. I worked with young people from Spanish Harlem who lived in a different world than the one I had grown up in. And then being in Berkeley in the 60s, of course, was a huge wake-up call to really things that are still with me and have animated my journey for a very long time, things like hope and the possibility of social change and the necessity of community to get there. So I value that experience very deeply. I finished my PhD in the late 60s, and by that time, the cities were burning and my heroes had been assassinated. And so the plan that I had originally had to go into academia to become a professor just seemed not to be my path anymore. And instead I went to Washington, D.C. and I became a community organizer working on issues of racial justice and community stabilization in a rapidly changing part of D.C. called Tacoma Park East Silver Spring. I did that work for 5 years, kind of created an institute with a couple of other people. And at that time, there was all kinds of federal and foundation funding available for work of that sort. And at the end of 5 years, I burned out. I was a pretty thin-skinned person at the time and had discovered during that period the writing of Thomas Merton, this great figure of the 20th century, Trappist monk, who, despite the fact that he lived within the monastic walls, was deeply connected with the great social movements of his time, with racial justice and with the anti-war movement. He was a sort of patron saint for a lot of people in those movements. And so, inspired in part by him, and yet being married with three kids and realizing that I wasn't about to move to a monastery, I found my way eventually, my wife and I found our way to Pendle Hill, P-E-N-D-L-E, Hill. It's a Quaker adult study center and living learning community near Philadelphia. We lived there, we thought we were going there for just a year-long sabbatical from my work as a community organizer, excuse me. I live in Wisconsin, winter has set in and a little cold has come with it. But that year turned out to be so compelling, living in this community of 80 people, sharing a daily round of worship, Quaker style, silent worship, physical work, taking care of the place, eating meat three meals a day together, making decisions together, Quaker meetings based on consensus, and studying together in a wonderful curriculum with some wonderful teachers. That lifestyle proved so compelling that I applied for and became Dean of Studies in Pendle Hill and never returned to my community organizing. I spent the next, I spent the next 10 years at Pendle Hill, so it was 11 years altogether of life in this very different kind of setting, where there was radical equality. Everybody who worked there made the same amount of money. There weren't any status differentials. It didn't matter that I had a PhD and was Dean of Studies. I made the same amount of money and had the same responsibilities as an 18-year-old who came to cook in the kitchen or work in the garden because he or she didn't know where to go with the rest of their life. And I think for somebody like me, who came out of a lot of privilege, I don't think, I'll never claim that one loses totally one's sense of entitlement, which is a bad thing and you need to lose it. But I think 11 years at Pendle Hill, living under those circumstances of radical equality that I just described, really ground away at my sense of entitlement in a way that I'm very grateful for. It was a period of time that opened me to other people's gifts, to the possibilities of human community, to the human possibility itself, because once you strip away all the external trappings of position and power and wealth, we have so much in common deep down, and I think that that's driven my work ever since. So somewhere in there, just to bring this story to a close, I decided that I wanted to become a writer, and spent a couple of years thinking, well, that's not happening because I'm not getting published. And then I read somebody who said, a writer is distinguished by the fact that he writes. And I thought, oh, wow, what a what a breakthrough that is. So I just started writing and writing without regard to publication. But when you do that, I think often things start leaking out and making it into print. Sure. And so, as you said, now many years later, I have 9 books out there. I'm working on number 10. And along with that, along with those books, has come a desire that I think dates back to the impulse that made me a community organizer instead of an academic sociologist. And that's the impulse to put wheels on ideas, to create vehicles with ideas that people can ride toward good destinations of their own choosing. Mm. And so that's one way to explain why, about 25 years ago, I planted the seeds for a nonprofit organization that is now known as the Center for Courage and Renewal. We now have, amazingly, 320 very well-trained facilitators. Beautiful. Working all over this country and all over the world with people in the helping professions. And we take them through a series of intensive retreats where the goal is, as I like to put it, to rejoin soul and role. Hmm. Or to use slightly different language, to help people bring their identity and integrity more fully into their public and professional lives. And as you well know, and I'm sure anyone who's watching this program knows, there are a lot of people in the helping professions, a lot of K-12 teachers, a lot of healthcare folk, a lot of clergy, a lot of nonprofit leaders who are finding it very, very difficult these days to maintain their vocational commitments under conditions of scarcity and duress and feeling devalued. And so our work at the Center for Courage and Renewal is to help people reclaim their vocational passions, to reclaim what Thomas Merton would call true self. And to finally get to a point of saying, I went into teaching, to take one example, because I was passionate about being in the service of children. Mm. And I'm not going to let anybody's legislation or anybody's bureaucracy or any kind of incompetent leadership take that passion away from me. It defines who I am. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing worse than handing your identity over, defaulting on your identity to some force outside of yourself that wants you to be something different. And so the words courage and renewal in the title of our organization aren't accidental. I think what we do is we help people renew those vocational commitments, passions, the heart of the teacher, the heart of the healer, et cetera. Mm. And then we help them find the courage in community. These retreats are all done in community over time. So it's not just a single weekend or a one-off experience. We help them find the courage to act on the imperatives of their own souls. Mm. As we always say, we don't know what you need, your soul knows best, but we know something about creating the conditions under which the voice of the soul, or I'm a Quaker, as we Quakers would say, the inner teacher, can be heard. And once you've heard it, you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube.
Absolutely.
So then you have to find the courage to follow whatever it's telling you. So That's where I am today. They call me founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal. And I'm very lucky to now be working with my third generation of leadership in carrying that 25-year-old organization forward. Mm. And they're doing the heavy lifting. I get to be grandpa, you know, who has the kids over occasionally and enjoys them a lot and learns a lot from them. And I'll just say finally, to bring it to an update of this moment, that 6 or 8 years ago, we realized that we needed to start working very intentionally with what we call young leaders and activists. Mm. So I've been very involved for the last 6 or 8 years in doing retreats for people between 25 and 40 years of age who are in these helping professions that I've named and others. Journalism is another one, community organizing, social change. Some very remarkable people, helping them deal with the slings and arrows that even young people experience for all of their passion and enthusiasm about the work they're doing, helping them, I think, lead more sustainable lives. Because in our day and time, and this is nothing new to the folks listening to this, those are the people we desperately need to open the path to a better world, which at the moment we really, really don't have. Although we now have a lot of stuff on the table that we should have been dealing with for a very long time, and now maybe we have a chance to deal with it. So my work with young leaders and activists is something that really, really rolls my socks these days.
And you're right, Parker, it is so important. I mean, this is the next generation. It's like to say, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, right? So we create that foundation and then we're able to share our wisdom and pass it forward. And it sounds like, you know, you've been on an incredible journey in your life, and the experience of being with that Quaker community seems to have really humbled you, maybe brought out a sense of humility and the ability of being in service to the world more deeply.
I value very deeply my journey with the Quakers, which started at age 35. I wasn't raised as a Quaker. But they have a remarkable way of bringing the inner and outer life together. And I know, Val, that that's a great interest of yours and in this program. And for 350 years, they've been the folks who have sat in silence, looking to all the world as if they were doing nothing. But then out of that silence, finding these, what Quakers would call leadings, or these imperatives of the heart and of the soul, and showing up then in disproportionate numbers to their very small size in the women's movement, in the anti-war movement, in relief movements following war, peacemaking movements of various sorts, and in the struggle for racial justice. One of the things that attracted me to Quakers was the question, so what's this mystery of how people who sit in silence and seem to be doing nothing, then go into the world and do more than a lot of religious communities do actively, who have a lot more members than the Quakers will ever have?
Yes, and the answer is in the question.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I finally learned that.
It's like we move so fast in this world when we take time to allow ourselves to be in that space of stillness. You know, we really get to tap into how our soul speaks to us, how our heart speaks to us, how we're motivated to show up in the world.
It's a very interesting thing, isn't it? And I'm sure you see this too, is that a lot of people in our world are fearful of the silence, of the stillness, because they fear that they're going to get to know themselves better than they want to, that things will rise up in them that will be frightening, or in some way offend their sense of self. Mm. And, you know, they're not altogether wrong. We all have a shadow side.
Yes.
And sitting in silence can bring that forward. But part of what I've learned on my journey, and as I think you know from reading my books, because I've written about this several times, part of my journey has been three deep dives into clinical depression. And if there's, I write about it and I speak about it because I think it's an important way for me to make meaning out of what would otherwise be a meaningless experience. And it's a way to connect to the many people in this world who are either suffering from depression or who are close to someone who is. And these are depressing times. I mean, there's a part of me that wants to say, if you're not depressed, you're probably a little crazy. And not, you know, you're crazy if you're depressed. I do not believe that. So one of the things I've learned the hard way is that if you don't really look at your shadow and explore your shadow, those dark impulses that arise within you in the silence, then it has more power over you than if you do look at it and explore it and understand it. Absolutely. And once you start to explore your shadow and understand your shadow, it turns out, as wiser people than I have often said, that it has a lot to teach you, and that there's an interesting way in which it wants to befriend you. It wants to draw your attention to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been a big piece of my life journey, that in the silence not only comes light and leadings and guidance that we wouldn't otherwise get, and clarity and all those good things, but there also comes this shadow material that has a befriending impulse to it, and that the life journey is really toward integrating the shadow and the light. I'm very fond of saying wholeness does not mean perfection. It means embracing everything about you that's imperfect and saying, along with my gifts and strengths, this too is who I am. And I think that sometimes in our line of work, as it were, that this word wholeness gets confused with a kind of drive to perfection.
Yes.
That actually doesn't liberate people. It actually shuts them down and stops them in their tracks.
Mm.
So sort of every day, one of my personal exercises is to say, yeah, Parker, you're an imperfect human being in an imperfect world. So what else is new? How are we going to use those imperfections on behalf of something better? Because it can be done.
It can be, and it must be. I mean, that's the great, I think, invitation of this moment. I think you called the politics of our world or the politics of the brokenhearted. And I wanted to read something, actually, because that you brought this up about embracing all that we are and being in the space of allowing ourselves to feel into this sadness or the depression or what's occurring right now. I want to actually read something from your book, if I can.
Okay.
It just sums it up so beautifully. And this is from Healing the Heart of Democracy, talking about the human heart, right? As we're talking about the endless capacity of the human heart to hold us. And you say about the heart, that it's where we can learn how to think the world together, not apart, and find the courage to act on what we know. If you hold your knowledge of self and world wholeheartedly, your heart will at times get broken by loss, failure, defeat, betrayal, or death. What happens next in you and the world around you depends on how your heart breaks. If it breaks apart into 1,000 pieces, the result may be anger, depression, and disengagement. If it breaks open into greater capacity to hold the complexities and contradictions of the human experience, the result may be new life. And you go on to talk about, you know, the politics in the hands of those whose hearts have been broken open rather than apart helps us hold our differences creatively and use our power courageously for the sake of a more equitable, just, and compassionate world. And I think that really touches on the need for us right now to allow our hearts to break open and to be able to be with that in the sense of wholeness and recognizing all that's alive inside of us. knowing that what's happening in our outer world is also happening in our inner world. You know, those things are just mirrors of each other. They just flow one to the other.
Yeah, I'm glad you named that or brought that up, because I think that's, I agree with you that that's a terribly important piece of the puzzle right now. You know, I do think that this notion of a heart that breaks open instead of apart is a very realistic notion. I don't trade in illusions, I hope. I certainly try not to. But let me give you an example of what I mean by realistic and the broken open heart. So I'm 77 years old, and I know at my age a lot of people who have recently lost or are in the process of losing the most beloved person in their lives, right? And I know that when that person is gone, the folks that I'm familiar with go into that underground passage that we call grieving, that profound sense of loss during which you think life will never be worth living again. I recognize it because I've been there in clinical depression, and so have lots of other people. But then, so many of them, and this is just human nature 101, I think, so many of them slowly awaken to the fact that not in spite of that loss, but because of that loss, they've become larger people. They've become more open. They've become more forgiving. They've become more compassionate. They're more likely to let the stranger into their lives. Their hearts have not been shattered, but they've been stretched to a greater capacity to hold joy and suffering alike, their own and other people's. That's just reality. You can see it in the lives around you as you get to know other people. And I really think that you know, it's not just in old age and the loss of someone you love, but anyone who's ever raised a teenager probably has a similar journey of heartbreak that way. And has come to understand the capacity of keeping that heart open, so that even though the relationship seems terminally strained and even broken, there's a way back. There's the possibility of a rejoining of lives. And so the question isn't, do we have that capacity? Of course we do. There's evidence for it. The question is, can we apply it to social life, to political life? And I think we can. I think the sadness is that we don't look at these, at politics, for example, through those lenses. So as you know, when I wrote The Courage to, or I'm sorry, Healing the Heart of Democracy, there was a lot of talk, and there still is, about the politics of rage. Many people will say that, it was rage that animated this last election. And I don't deny that there was some energy of rage in it. But I think behind rage, there's always a wound. And the wound, I have no problem calling the wound heartbreak. And so I talk about not the politics of rage, but the politics of the brokenhearted. Because we can't treat a condition if we have the wrong diagnosis. You know, if we want to be doctors of the body politic, we need a good diagnosis of what's going on. And there's a lot of heartbreak in this country that we need to become more sensitive to and treat. And I think a lot of people are waking up to that fact right now. I think that, you know, it's barely tolerable for many of us to see over the course of this campaign the denigration of women, the denigration of LGBTQ people, the denigration of Muslims, the denigration of African Americans, the denigration of Mexicans, of, you know, of anybody who's other. And the manipulation of all of that for the gaining of political power, you know, as if it were a realistic economic plan to say, if we keep all those people out of our country, then you're going to get your jobs back. That's just a con game, yeah. Plain and simple. And I think people will start to realize that who once bought into it, that they have been conned. But there is in that an undiagnosed heartbreak about what people look at as losses, but can be reframed as gains. As far back as 1969 to 1974, when I was a community organizer in Washington, D.C., I saw my basic work as helping a lot of white people who look like me, in this rapidly changing community, to understand that there were joys and values and vitalities in a diverse community that weren't available in a homogeneous white community. In the first place, a homogeneous white community is a myth. There is no such thing. There's just a bunch of white people pretending that they're all alike so that they won't touch those points of difference where things might explode. So, to me, homogeneous white community is a mythical phrase. And when churches, for example, ask me to come in and help them become more diverse because they're a homogeneous white community, I said, well, I'm just not going to do that unless you're willing to confront the fact that you can't even deal with your own internal differences. And if you can't do that, why would someone with a visible external difference ever want to join you? You know, if you can't listen to the person in the pew next to you who has a gay son or a lesbian daughter and who is trying to find a way to say, I love this child in a community that's going to be scandalized by that. If you can't do that, which a lot of you can't do, why would someone with a visible difference want to come and sit with you? I certainly wouldn't. My work in that community was to say, look, diversity has energy in it. Diversity has vitality. Diversity has color and flair. Diversity has all the things that we don't get when we're all recycling the same conversation and breathing the same cultural experience because that's all we got.
Even if we look at it ecologically, you know, our world thrives on diversity.
Absolutely. Thrives on it. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The unplowed prairies with 140 species of plants were a lot more resilient, for example.
Absolutely.
And I'm in the Midwest. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. The farmland around me has two or three species, corn, soybeans, wheat, whatever. Yeah. And it is not resilient. And we pay a big price for that. So, yeah, I think the politics of the brokenhearted is a very important topic to pursue, or a very important diagnostic lens through which to look at things. And I'm interested in forms of leadership, whether it's in teaching or medicine or ministry or nonprofit or politics, that reframe things for people. It's one of the big acts of leadership to reframe things for people in a way that says, this isn't a curse, it's a blessing. Or there's a blessing on the other side of the curse. And we should be paying attention to that and seeing how we can maximize it. I mean, I know, to put it baldly, I know a lot of really terminally bored white middle and upper middle class people like myself, whose lives would be a lot more interesting if their hearts would break open to the experience of diversity, where suddenly someone from the other side of the planet is trusting you enough to tell you about what their life is like, and they're wanting to know what your life is like, and you're becoming larger. I'll just say one more thing about this. To me, there's a spiritual practice that makes it more rather than less likely that our hearts will break open instead of apart. And that spiritual practice has to do with any way we have of keeping our hearts supple. I'm just fascinated with these daily experiences of little deaths or little losses. You know, I'll give you a quick example. Real life example. I just had an article rejected. Now, obviously, I thought it was a brilliant article. I'm sure it was. But this particular editor didn't. And I learned about that last night. And, you know, I was on the surface, it was rage. I was angry. How dare she? But underneath, it was heartbreak. It was like, I invested myself in that article for 3 days, you know, and I said what I wanted to say. And here's somebody telling me, you know, they're not going to publish it. That doesn't make any sense, right? So I got up at 5 o'clock this morning and I reread the email of rejection. And I embraced that little death, which I had really been agonizing over last night. And I sat down and I started rewriting the article along some lines that she had suggested.
There it is.
And just before we went on air, I got a note saying, beautiful rewrite, we're going to run it. And so this is no big deal in the total scheme of things, but it makes my heart feel more supple, you know, to find the meaning in what would otherwise be a crushing or meaningless experience, to move beyond the anger or the hurt that's beneath the anger, to embrace the creative possibility that's there. You know, I mean, part of my back, I think I'm a guy who keeps turning the prism on the spiritual traditions and seeing the light refracted in beautifully different ways by different traditions, heavily influenced by Taoism, by Buddhism, by the mystic stream in Catholicism and in Islam, Quakerism with its emphasis on the light, and traditional Christianity in my own background. And in the terms of my background, what I'm talking about is resurrection, right? It's the new life that can come out of something that you think has died. And it's, to me, it's a theme that runs through all the traditions and that is one way to keep the heart supple by embracing those little deaths and looking for those little resurrections.
Beautiful. And it's also an invitation to reframe the story, as you were saying before. You know, so instead of this being like, oh, this rejection and taking it in that way, it can be, what an invitation for me to take another look at what I wrote and how I can approach it in maybe a stronger way or a way that speaks to people more deeply. And here's an opportunity for me to grow into that too.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, it's like maybe, just maybe, my critics have something to teach me, right? It's like, what a novel idea that is.
Right. And those inner critics were like, I got you.
Calm down. So it's, you know, and one of the things I say in Healing the Heart of Democracy, as you know, is that if I were asked to name two words that are important in having the voice of a citizen in this pluralistic, diverse world of ours, the two words would be chutzpah and humility.
Yes, I love it.
And of course, what I mean is the courage to speak your own voice, because we all have something important to say from where we stand, but the humility to understand that we don't stand everywhere. Mm. And we need to listen to people who are standing in other places. And then we need to meet in the middle and come to a better place and a better world.
Yes, and it's how we can grow deeper in relationship. You know, it's like we grow exponentially when we're in relationship to the other, because it allows us to reflect upon ourselves in ways that we can't always see.
Absolutely, it does. Yeah, I often speak with younger people about this, because part of what we do in these young leader and activist retreats is really try to build on the value of intergenerational conversation.
Mm, beautiful.
And I say, you know, I know that you guys have your critics right now, right? Every time you put something out there, write something, do something, somebody comes at it, especially online, maybe a lot of somebodies, very critically. And some of it is just to be dismissed because it's drive-by criticism, it's irresponsible, it's anonymous. Who cares, you know? But there's some of it that where somebody's really engaging you in a meaningful difference. And I said, you know, when I was your age, I would get critics of that sort. And I came to value them very deeply. It always stung, but I came to value them because they forced me to rethink things. And maybe I found I was wrong, maybe I found I was right, but if I was right, I needed to find a new way to articulate what I thought was right, to build a bridge rather than a wall between me and my critics. And I said, you know, one of the things that I miss, having become better known and regarded as an expert, which we could talk about that later. I do not think of myself as an expert. I mean, the truth is I was born baffled, and everything I've ever done has come out of that bafflement, not out of any expertise. And I'm going to die baffled too.
That's perfect. I think it's Rilke who says, live the questions, right?
Yeah, live the questions.
Yeah, blessed are the baffled.
Exactly. Yeah. Bafflement is my religion. So, and my gift, and it drives me and it animates me. But I miss the critics these days, because when you become well known and you've got 9 or 10 books, and they either, you know, they may figure he's not worth talking to because he's got his mind made up, or he knows all the arguments, and, I'm not going to win one with him. I don't know what it is, but I miss the critics because they are the ones who in earlier years kept me sharp. Well, I can't say I don't have any of them. I just told you about an editor.
Really, Parker.
So I've got a few left, and God
bless. You're asking for it. It's right there.
God bless them.
I love, you know, everything we're talking about is really how do we come to know ourselves in our inner world, and how do we show up in our outer world, right? So there's this breath of being present to what's in us, and there's this invitation to what's happening outside of us. And you have this beautiful metaphor that you use in your work of the Mobius strip.
Yeah.
I'd love you to talk to us a little bit about that, because first of all, what is a Mobius strip? I'm sure some people have never heard that term before. And how are you using that as a metaphor for everything that we're talking about right now?
Oh, thank you. I'd love to do that. And I actually, knowing that you might ask that question, I brought illustration with me. So, I'm a Quaker, as I said, and Quakers are prohibited from doing PowerPoints, but we can do this simple thing with a strip of paper, I think. I don't think they're going to throw
it's
me
much
out.
Much more interesting than a PowerPoint any day.
We'll see. So what I say when I work with groups, Val, is if you can imagine that, let's say maroon or purple side of this strip of paper represents your inner life, and this white side represents your outer life, the face you present to the world. And the relevant words on the outside of your life are words like image, influence, and impact. You know, like, am I making a difference? How do I look while I'm doing it? Do they like me? All of that sort of reputational stuff that we concern ourselves about as we do our work. But if you flip the strip over, then back here, you've got words like identity and integrity, heart, soul, beliefs, convictions, values, you know, all of the things that actually animate us, and all of the things that are about our identity, which it's sometimes difficult to show up with in the outer world, or so we think. So what I call life on the Mobius strip can be physically represented this way. And let me just get it up here so that I make sure that it's on camera. So if you take this piece of paper and you form it this way, to as if you were about to make a circle, and hold one end steady and give the other end a half twist and then rejoin it, you make this very interesting form called a Mobius strip, M-O-B-I-U-S. It's a shape actually generated originally by mathematicians, which is a whole interesting mystery in itself. What's fascinating about this shape is that it obviously a three-dimensional object in three-dimensional space, but it has only one side, which is, talk about bafflement, there's one for you. So you can demonstrate that by taking your finger and tracing it along what seems to be the outside of that strip until you suddenly and seamlessly come onto what appears to be the inside of that strip, and you keep tracing it around, and you suddenly and seamlessly come back to what seems to be the outside of that strip. So the message of the Mobius strip, and I think this is very interesting for people who me talk about the inner and outer life, the message of the Mobius strip is there ain't no inner and outer. The two keep co-creating each other. Mm. So at each of these points of juncture, either the inside flows into the outside and helps co-create what's out there, or the outside flows into the inside and helps co-create what's in here. Mm. There are these points of exchange where co-creation is constantly going on. And when I first saw that, I got an immediate hit. I thought, that's exactly how life works. So we're doing this interview right now, just to be very in the moment about it. I have some dim awareness that a fair number of people are going to look at this. And I have some awareness, because I know some of the other names on your program, wonderful people, people I've read, people I admire, that they're going to do a great job. And maybe all of that put together brings me to this interview with, let's say, fear, which is an emotion that tends to shut us down and evoke the lesser angels of our nature, not the better angels of our nature. What I need to understand is that yes, I have places of fear inside me. That's part of my inner landscape. But I have other places in there as well. I have a sense of community with you and with the cause that you represent and with these other people. I have a sense that we're all in this together and we all want to make our little contribution to the larger good. And I have choices to make about where I stand within myself on that inner landscape as I approach and come into the outer world. Mm. And if what I bring forth is not fear but faith, let's say just for shorthand, then I'm going to co-create something a little better than I would if I went forward with my fear. Because when I go forward with my fear, people react negatively. They either want to exploit it, or it makes them afraid, or whatever, but it's not a good result. I go forward with my faith in the human possibility, then we're more likely to do something good together. And then if we go further around the Mobius strip and think about the fact that the world, once we go out there, then the external world throws stuff back at us. And we have choices to make about how we internalize it and appropriate it. And just like I made a choice this morning about how to internalize and appropriate the criticism that this editor had given to a piece that I had worked very hard on.
Right.
And I decided not to appropriate that in a defended way, but to ask myself, is there something I can learn from this? And can I try again and maybe this time get it right, or at least get it better? So I think in a lot of ways, my spiritual life revolves around this question. As I travel the Mobius Strip every moment of every day, how can I be so conscious of what's going on, so conscious of this co-creative inner-outer exchange, that I can make choices at each point of exchange that are on balance more life-giving than death-dealing?
Yes.
So repeat the question again. So as I travel the Mobius Strip every moment of every day, how can I become more aware, more conscious of these points of co-creative exchange so that I can make choices about what I put out and how I take stuff back in that are on balance more life-giving than death-dealing? That on balance is an important phrase for me because there ain't no perfection. And when we hold ourselves to that standard, we defeat ourselves. We don't get better, we get worse. Because we get discouraged and we may even, withdraw from the field. But if I can learn to forgive myself for my slip-ups and forgive the world for some of its stuff, then I can, on balance, make choices that are more life-giving than death-dealing. So that's life on the Mobius Strip.
Parker, it's such an amazing metaphor. It's so powerful. What an invitation to take a look at ourselves and show up in a way that becomes mutually enhancing life, like you're saying. And it is so interesting because, it's making me think of this magazine called Adbusters that was out a long time ago. I never see it around anymore, but it was a journal for your mental environment. So it would take a look at how we were affected by the images, the advertisements, and all the things that we're bombarded with. And that includes, what's happening politically, what's happening on every level. How do we take that in to our inner environment? And how does that then, coupled with our core wounds, the ways that we've shown up in the world and the ways that we've been shaped and sculpted, what does that do within us? And then how do we take all of that information in a very conscious way and make those choices that you're saying to live in a way that's life-giving, that's really enhancing for ourselves and our world and each other and other animals and our future generations, and take all of that into consideration?
Yes.
Powerful invitation. Powerful invitation on that.
Yeah. And I just like the simplicity of the image. Yeah. And for a lot of people, I think, who've seen it, there's a kind of aha moment, when they put it together that way. oh, right, there isn't really an inner and an outer.
Right.
You know, as if we could retreat to the inner and then somehow re-engage the outer.
Right. What face do we show? How do we really show our true self? How do we recognize what that is, first of all?
Right.
Really get into that and recognize what is here for us. Who are we really? What's alive inside of us? And then how do we live that? You know, how do we reconcile that to live it out in a most honest way?
Exactly. And I think, you know, a kind of sub-question there, Val, is how can we understand the retreat that we so badly need into silence or solitude or whatever as a form of engagement in itself, you know, a form that will take us back into the world. I mean, I think one of the dangers in the movement that you and I care about is, of course, narcissism, which is the inner journey that just ends up inside. I always like to tell people that my favorite book title in recent years is a collection of poems by Tony Hoagland called What Narcissism Means to Me, which I think is just a brilliant title. I really envy that title. But there's a lot of that going around. And it happens, I think, when we misunderstand the inner journey or the inner life as a disengagement from our responsibilities in the world or from our relationships.
Yes.
That's not the inner life. That's a pathology of some sort. A good test of the inner life is if it's taking you back into the outer world with, you know, with your feet more solidly on the ground and your heart more open to receive in a creative way whatever the world throws back at you.
Yeah, and there's that Mobius strips, like the deeper we allow ourselves to be present, the more we allow ourselves to be present, the deeper we go within us, it brings us back into how we show up in the world.
Yeah.
Into ourselves more clearly.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm. Very beautiful, very powerful. And then we have to ask the question, so then how can we show up and what can we recognize? And I'm thinking now like your five habits of the heart. So, you know, we're talking about like how can we show up with the chutzpah and with our humility, you know, and how do we deal with what we're receiving right now in our world, you know, because we are so on every level charged right now.
Right.
It's become very extreme on both ends of the spectrum and we're being invited to show up more powerfully. And so what does that look like for us when we start diving into that question, like, well, what do we do with this? All right, we know we need to feel it. We know we need to go into the space. We know we need to reconcile who we are and how we show up. So how do we do it? And the five habits of the heart that you display so beautifully in The Heart of Democracy, Healing the Heart of Democracy, I think is a wonderful way in.
Well, thank you. So let me just say a little bit about that and then you can take us anywhere you'd like to go. You know, I start the book out with a quote from a great writer, Terry Tempest Williams. I really love her stuff. And I'm just going to read that quote here. I don't have it memorized, but she says, "The human heart is the first home of democracy. It is where we embrace our questions. Can we be equitable? Can we be generous? Can we listen with our whole beings, not just our minds, and offer our attention rather than our opinions? And do we have enough resolve in our hearts to act courageously, relentlessly, without giving up ever, trusting our fellow citizens to join with us in our determined pursuit of a living democracy?" I love that quote because it, instead of locating democracy in Washington, D.C., or in the state capitol, or in the Constitution, or in history, and of course, parts of it are in all of those places, but it begins in the human heart. That's actually where it began in the hearts of the founders and of all the, those who struggled before the founders got around to it. And the human heart is a very mixed place. The founders really screwed up some very serious stuff. By we the people, they meant only white, male, landed gentry. Native peoples were excluded, women were excluded, enslaved human beings were excluded. You know, they planted some very bad DNA in this country, and we're now, that DNA is now, as the geneticists say, expressing itself in our current pathologies. And, you know, the hopeful thing there is that we're now forced to look at it more clearly than before. And for some of us, at least, to try to do something more about it. This is not a romantic statement that Terry Tempest Williams has made, because she's very aware of the complexities of the human heart. And she's basically saying it's full of questions, and a lot depends on how we answer those questions. And there's no guarantee that we're going to answer them correctly. One more thing to say is that in the book, I go back, as you know, to the root meaning of the word heart. It comes from the Latin cor, C-O-R, which ultimately means the cor, C-O-R-E, of the human self, where all of our faculties converge. So the heart isn't just the seat of emotions, as we often think of it today. It's not just what we express on Valentine cards.
Right.
The human heart is that place where everything that we got going for us converges. Intellect, will, feeling, intuition, bodily knowledge, relational knowledge, problem-solving knowledge. I mean, as we know, there are probably 10 or 12 measurable kinds of human intelligence. And the heart is that core place where they all come together. It's where what we know in our minds becomes what we know in our bones, which is a very different kind of knowing. Or to put it in the words of a 12th century theologian, words I've always loved, he talked about the absolute importance of human beings learning to think with the heart, with the mind descended into the heart. So we need to stop thinking from the top of the tower. We don't need to stop thinking. Some of us have to start thinking. We don't want to think from the top of the tower, which is an arrogant place, but from that grounded human place in the heart, with the mind descended into the heart. Think in a feelingful way. Think in an empathetic way. Think in a compassionate way. These things are possible, and we have images for them. So with that as context, I wrote about 5 habits of the heart, which I'll just name very quickly. An understanding that we're all in this together, number one. An appreciation of the value of otherness, number two. An ability to hold tension in a life-giving way, number three. A sense of personal voice and agency, number four, and a capacity to create community, number five. And I think a lot of what we're looking at right now is a breakdown in those habits of the heart, and can be traced to some extent to our failure to teach those habits in the local venues of life. The family, the civic community, the school, the religious community, the workplace, et cetera, et cetera. The habits of the heart, there's no one school you go to learn them. And some of us learn them from wise elders. My dad was a remarkable man who grew up in a blue-collar family, came to Chicago with a high school diploma, got a temporary bookkeeping job with a company in the middle of the Depression, and 50 years later was owner and chairman of the board of the same company. It was one of those stories, you know, that happened in the last century that isn't likely to happen again. But he had a deep conviction as a businessman, as a successful businessman, that he needed to pay it forward, that he owed to other people the same kind of opportunities that this country had given him as a blue-collar kid from Waterloo, Iowa, to achieve his dreams. So he hired people who weren't necessarily the best and the brightest, but who had promise and needed opportunity, had not been given opportunity. Because he believed that he owed to the society the kind of opportunity he had been given as a young man of few means. And he was a good teacher, so he taught people work habits and so forth and so on, the skills necessary in business, and helped a lot of people rise. So he had this understanding that we're all in this together and that we need to pay it forward, and that that there is a value in otherness, which in his case meant bringing in folks who came from different backgrounds and didn't have the same kinds of qualifications that most companies were looking for in that day and age. And so my point was that I learned habits of the heart in a variety of places, but it doesn't always have to be schools or congregations or civic communities or workplaces. It can sometimes be a wise elder like my father, who taught those habits to me. And I think we just need to pay a lot more attention to teaching young people, children and youth, these habits of the heart that are actually the key to good citizenship. We have a big confusion here. Because in our schools, back in the day when they were teaching civics, and I'm afraid they aren't even doing much of that anymore, because they're all knotted up with high-stakes testing around stuff that, well, that's another subject, but we could talk about it if you like. It's the high-stakes testing thing is strangling public education and wounding a lot of teachers and a lot of kids. But back in the day when civics was taught, we weren't doing it very well even then. We were teaching kids to memorize dates and places and battles and names of American heroes and documents they needed to know about. Of course, all of that stuff has some marginal importance. But in terms of being a citizen, does the ability to recite each and every amendment to the Constitution of the United States really qualify you for life in a civic society? I don't think so. Yeah. I think it's more these habits of the heart that I've named that allow you to engage in the democratic process in a way that is democratic, of all things.
And I'm feeling into the recent election, all that's been happening with that, and this idea of, well, two main ones, that we're all in this together, and the appreciation of the other has been so trampled on. The way we haven't really been listening, and it becomes this us versus them, rather than that feeling of we all want something to shift. We may have different ideas and different perspectives about what that looks like, but we all really want that. So let's have this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Let's have
the conversation rather than the confrontation.
And it's that, that's a. I think, Val, that's a. And this is where I think it's important that we say clearly that what you just named is a problem, not only on the right but also on the left.
Oh yes, right.
We all have it.
We all have it. We have not been opening ourselves to each other, right? And even saying the right and the left, or the, Hillary supporters or the Trump supporters. Everything feels so like we're polar opposites and we have to act out that role, versus we have different ideas and we're fed so much misinformation. And how can we get into a deeper conversation that allows us to move forward together?
Yeah, and I think I have just a couple things to share with you about that, Val. I know that's a question on all of our minds, and I'm glad you raised it. So one of the things I say in the book is I'm prepared to grant that as many as 20% of the people on the right and 20% of the people on the left will not be able to engage in the kind of conversation that you and I have in mind. They're so dug in ideologically, or they're so afraid of what it would be to let the other into their lives, that it'll be a long time before they'll be open to the conversation. But that doesn't trouble me, because 20% there and 20% there leaves 60% in the middle. Yeah. And in a democracy, that's more than enough to get business done. And business has been done with that 60%. We're making significant progress, for example, towards a constitutional amendment that would overturn the toxic effects of Citizens United, mm-hmm. big money, this big bullhorn.
Yep.
That's a remarkable achievement that has been made possible only because people on the right and people on the left have said, oh, we have our differences, but we have a common enemy, and it's called crony capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called the influence of big money.
Mm.
We want to come together around that shared concern and do something about it. What I think is really important is that we start to understand a very simple axiom. In these conversations across lines of ideological difference, it's more important to be in right relationship than it is to be right.
Mm.
And let me be clear about what I mean by that. I'm not talking about giving up on what each of us thinks to be right. I mean, we have value differences, we have policy differences. But it turns out that what's right is often very complicated.
Mm.
I'm a big fan of a certain form of, well, I'll just call it socialized medicine. I wish we had a single payer plan,
yeah.
that all American citizens could employ, could have access to, and that was affordable, and that covered some of the things Obamacare covers. But it's a true statement that, and advocates of Obamacare have said this time and time again, that mistakes were made in Obamacare that we're now paying a price for, we, the consumers of healthcare. And it may be that this will lead to a complete overthrow of Obamacare and a period of chaos when nothing new has taken its place. That's a possibility on the political landscape right now.
Right.
My point is that we have our opinions on healthcare, but what's the right thing to do in that situation or a million others is complicated. And if we can't be in right relationship with each other around these complicated questions, we're never going to get these things figured out. If we simply hurl our opinions at each other like weapons,
mm-hmm.
and fragment grenades, we're going to just blow the container open,
yeah.
and it will become less and less possible to hold that complex, ongoing, patient conversation that leads us towards something that's better than what we've got. Here's where the founders, for all of their wrongness, were right.
Mm.
They talked about a more perfect union.
Yeah.
Which is an inherent acknowledgement that they didn't give us perfection, they gave us a work in progress, and then they gave us a set of institutions that are designed not to solve problems, but to keep the complicated problems on the table long enough, and that may be a couple centuries, until we can get them right. mean, it took us a long time to correct the founder's image of who was included in We the People, right?
Right.
And we're still working on that. But we've made progress, and the progress we've made is due to these tension-holding structures that the founders gave us that didn't pretend to create utopia, but rather gave us a framework within which to keep working on a work in progress.
Yes.
So I think the trick, if there's a trick here, is to find ways to hold that container that allows us to put wheels on the idea that it's more important to be in right relationship than it is to be right.
Mm.
And the quick word I'll say about how that works is that all political conversations should start with telling our personal stories rather than throwing our personal opinions at each other.
That's beautiful.
If you and I can sit down,
yeah,
I've done it many times across lines of difference.
Yeah.
And I can say, before we talk about our political convictions, tell me something about where yours came from.
Mm.
Was there an elder in your life? Was there an experience in your life? Was there something in your life, the conditions in which you grew up, that will help me understand why you believe what you do? And then, if you will, I'd like to tell you my story. And that story would include the story I just told you about my dad, who was one of the most important people in my life. And it's a story I've often told to business people who've said to me, you know, business doesn't owe anything to anybody except the stockholders and investors. And when they turn to me and say, so what do you think about that? Looking for an argument,
right.
I say, let me tell you a story. And I tell them about my dad, and they can't argue that he was a successful businessman, because he was. And this is how he operated, and that's why I believe what I believe. And it has amazing consequences, with people kind of looking at their shoes and saying, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas if I had trotted out, you know, the latest data on the gross national product and economic growth, the conversation would have been fruitless, and the container would have been blown. We'd no longer be in right relationship.
I hear you. I mean, it's kind of giving it to, I think you talk about this as well, where you're talking about kind of that third thing, you know, be it the story or the metaphor or the poem, you know, that other way of communicating that brings us together.
Yeah.
You know, and it humanizes us, and it opens our hearts to the emotionality of the experience and to each other's journey. And it gives us a different understanding of each other. And from that space, we can absolutely have a more clear conversation that's not so combative.
That's a nice place to maybe begin to land this conversation with you that I've enjoyed so much. So you're referring there to the work we do through the Center for Courage and Renewal that I wrote about in a book called A Hidden Wholeness. The core of our work is creating circles of trust, which we think of as safe spaces for the soul to speak, for the inner teacher to speak, for identity and integrity to show up. So by safe spaces, we don't mean, you know, spaces in which nothing gripping or electrifying happens. But we mean spaces where people can show up as they are without fear of judgment or exclusion or marginalization. And we have a set of ground rules around how to constitute a safe space and some practices like the one you just mentioned. One of our key ground rules is that in a circle of trust, And I'm talking now about a retreat circle of 25 people who may take a two-year journey together through 8 retreats of 3 days each. Mm. And over that two-year period, one of our ground rules is no fixing, no saving, no advising, and no correcting each other. And people will say, well, what in heaven's name are we going to do for 2 years? You've just taken away the only things that we know how to do or that are any fun to do. And I'll say, yeah, we've also taken away the things that shut people down.
Yes.
When it comes to expressing their own truth. If I start to express my truth and somebody rushes at me to fix me or save me or advise me or correct me, I'm gone. I mean, my body may be present, but my soul is back in the underbrush. Mm. My truth is back in the underbrush. So we enforce that rule very rigorously. That's one of the things our facilitators are trained to do. And when people say, well, how are we to speak to each other? We say, well, a couple of things. We're each going to speak our own truth into the center of the circle rather than to another person. This is going to create a new form of community where we're not meeting around the circumference of the circle by turning left and turning right and saying, what do you think? Well, here's what I think. Mm. We're going to meet in the center of the circle where all of these stories now sit. And that's going to be the deepest place. If we speak from the center of ourselves to the center of the circle, that's going to be the deepest meeting you've ever experienced. And people come out saying, yeah, that's exactly right. And the second thing we're going to do is we're going to learn to ask each other honest, open questions. Mm. It turns out that asking each other honest, open questions is a high art, because most of us are trained to ask questions that promote an agenda.
Yeah.
That are advice in disguise, or that nudge a person toward where we think he or she ought to be. Mm. So I always like to say, have you thought about seeing a therapist is not an honest, open question. You know, if that's what's on your mind, just fess up and say, I think you should see a therapist, but that's advice and it's not allowed here. So ask an honest, open question like, you said you were distressed by this experience. Tell us more about how that felt or what that means to you.
Mm, beautiful.
It's an honest, open question to say, have you ever had an experience like this before in your life? And if you have, could you talk about it a little and maybe what you learned from that could be helpful now? Mm. You see, those kinds of questions, they do a couple of things. They, first of all, they serve to hear another person into deeper speech.
Yeah.
I love the phrase hearing into speech, which originated with a theologian named Nell Morton. It's a brilliant idea that the task in our time is to hear each other into speech. And then they help people peel back the layers within themselves of understanding themselves. I may not understand what you're saying, but if you understand it more clearly because of my honest open questions, then I'm serving you well. And so honest open questions play this very important role of creating a different kind of conversation. And then one more example of how we create safe space, as you said earlier, Val, we use what we call third things, and by that we mean voices, if I'll put that in quotes, that are other than the voice of the facilitator or the voice of one of the participants. So this would be the voice of a poet, yeah, or of a teaching story from a great spiritual tradition, or of a work of art, or of a piece of music. And we put that, as it were, in the center of the circle. And then invite people to respond to it. What does that evoke in you?
Yeah, that's
what strikes you about that? How does that draw you out? And what's interesting is that trust, you know, in our society is established slowly. And you can put if I were to turn to you and say, okay, Val, who are you? Tell me, you know, 10 things you've never told anybody else.
Yeah.
Or the deepest things about your identity, and tell me now. Well, there goes your soul back into the underbrush. That's not an invitation, that's a threat. But if I put a poem in the center of the circle, yeah. And there's 25 of us sitting around, and it's a poem by May Sarton called Now I Become Myself. I'll give you the first few lines. Now I become myself. It's taken time, many years and places. I have been shaken, worn other people's faces, run madly as if time were there crying a warning. Hurry, you will be dead before what? Before love is safe in the walled city where the morning comes clear. That's just the first few lines of the poem. I missed one word in there. I have been dissolved and shaken, worn other people's faces. Well, you put that poem out there, and people start talking about themselves at a level of depth without attaching their name to it, because they're commenting on lines in the poem.
Right.
But we all know it's about them. And as they do that and learn that they can talk about moments of being dissolved and shaken, the false faces that they have worn.
Yeah.
To mask their true identity. Or the good faces they tried on when they were young because they hadn't yet found their own face. And thank God I had my father's face to wear for a while until I figured out what mine was. As they do that, and as they realize, oh, they're very serious here about no fixing, no saving, no advising, and no correcting. And they're very serious here about hearing me into speech with honest, open questions. Then they come to trust the space enough in a fairly short period of time to start attaching their own name to what they say.
Beautiful.
And it's a beautiful thing to see.
And it's just some incredible tools to use in building community that feels safe to be ourselves.
A very different form of community, but absolutely the kind we need.
The kind we need right now so much.
Right.
Oh, Parker. Thank you so much for all of this incredible, just this journey through your life and all the wisdom that you've come to, that you're sharing with all of us. And this is such an important element. You know, I think right now we all need to find that community in a way that we can build our own circles of trust to be able to communicate, and not just with our own. The buzzword now is echo chamber, which includes, I think, other people repeating back to us, you know, the same conversation over and over, but inviting other people to come together that have different points of view, where we can really listen to each other and journey together and deepen our own understanding of ourselves and life through all these different viewpoints and experiences.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you, Belle. This has been a wonderful conversation, and it's a wonderful project you're on, and making a contribution to the goal that you just articulated.
Parker, thank you. And for those of you that want to find out more about Parker's work, you can go to couragerenewal.org, and I'll connect with you on Facebook, facebook.com/ParkerJPalmer. And we're going to have those links next to the videos as well, so you can just click on those and connect with Parker and find out more about this incredible work that you do.
Thank you
so much for this incredible conversation. Very grateful for you.
Thank you, and me for you. Be well.
You too.
Thank you.